And welcome into the Monday after Thanksgiving edition of the Doug Russell Podcast. Hope everyone had a great weekend. The Packers certainly did. They get a victory over their arch rivals. Also, a former Badger gets his shot. Will Giannis or won't Giannis? NBA TV's Brian Geltzeiler joins us. Also, College Hoops begins its season from the Big Ten Network and the Sporting News. The great Mike DeCourcy will join us later on in the program as well. It's a power-packed Monday show, so let's start with the Pack in prime time on Sunday Night Football.
Tyler Ervin inactive for the Packers, so they will send Malik Taylor back to receive, and we're underway with the 199th regular season meeting of the Packers and the Bears, and it will start from the 25-yard line with that guy. Aaron Rodgers turns 37 on Wednesday, likely to go over 50,000 passing yards for his career tonight. Third and 10, here is Rodgers with time. A whole bunch of it. End zone shot, Adams goes up and gets it. Touchdown, Green Bay. First and goal for the Packers, we begin the second quarter. And Rodgers on the roll to the end zone, Mercedes Lewis. Touchdown, Green Bay. Not tonight, the hamstring injury. First and goal, Green Bay. Rodgers backpedals, puts it up top. Touchdown, Green Bay.
That was so unbelievable. Mike
Allen Lazard with a leap to no one. Forced third down team in the league. Now it's third and 17. So the big rush from Gary. Trubisky lost the ball. It's scooped by Preston Smith, who takes it in for the Green Bay defensive touchdown. So Matt LaFleur got out of his playing days and then was a college coach and a graduate assistant and then jumps to the NFL. But Rodgers was already here, so you have to have an open mind to work together. Rodgers flips his hips, flips it downfield, wide open, tight end, touchdown, Packers. And Aaron was like a kid again.
Highlights courtesy of NBC Sports. Mike Tirico and Tony Dungy had the call. The Packers thrashed the Bears 41-25, but for all intents and purposes, this one was over in the third quarter when the score was 41-10. After it was over, Aaron Rodgers joined NBC's Catherine Tappan.
Aaron, congratulations on the win tonight. You passed 50,000 career passing yards, another milestone for you. What does it mean for you to continue to hit these milestones in your career?
It means I've been playing for a long time. I think, you know, some of those are longevity records. Feels good. I'm in my 16th season. I've seen a lot of ball, played a lot of ball. This was a good one tonight for us, so.
Aaron, second week in a row, you have all your playmakers out there with you. What does it mean to you to have your supporting cast now and feeling the rhythm out there on the field?
Yeah, I mean, that was really good offense tonight. We moved the ball efficiently in the first half, scored all three possessions. Had, you know, some nice drives in the second half. The key tonight was our defense. Started off really hot. Obviously scored a touchdown. Preston Smith had a great game. But it was a good night spreading the ball around. I missed Devontae on a throw. I hit 99 out of 100. So I'm disappointed by that one. But to get Robert Tunney involved, Alan Lazard with a touchdown, it was a fun night for us on offense.
When you look big picture at this win tonight, Aaron, what did you learn most about your team?
Well, this was a big one for us. I never say must win, but it was important for us, you know, to win this one. We're up three games to five to go in a division. Rivalry game, love beating Chicago. You know, they're Green Bay's biggest rival. Played a lot of these games. They all come down the same way. It's a physical game. I thought up front we did a great job on the line of scrimmage. Aaron Jones, Jamal Williams ran the ball hard. So we'll get back, we'll regroup, and get ready for Philly.
All right, Aaron, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Aaron Rodgers with NBC Sports sideline reporter Catherine Tappan on Sunday Night Football. So the Packers improved to 8-3, and they're in the driver's seat for another division crown.
That was a great team win. That's a good football team. You know, just I thought we were physical. I thought we brought a lot of energy. Certainly appreciative of the people in the stands cheering for us. I thought that was big time for us. But all in all, we knew it was going to be a physical football game, and I thought our guys did an outstanding job.
Packers coach Matt LaFleur. So this was was a ball game that began up front on offense.
I think anytime you can get the run game going, I think we did a nice job of being able to call some keepers and play actions that just kind of help keep the defense a little bit more off balance. But, you know, that's a credit to those guys. Again, they make those plays come to life. I thought Aaron did an outstanding job of throwing on rhythm, getting the ball out of his hands.
I thought the line played great, you know, really didn't get hit a whole lot all night. That was the key. I thought Matt did a great job mixing up the launch point, a number of keepers in the first half. We had some action, not a ton of straight drop back stuff. We helped out the edges. I thought it was a really good game plan and executed to near perfection in the first half, which was what we needed getting off to a fast start. Aaron ran excellent. Jamal was great. Both those guys, I think, combined for over 160 yards. That's a credit to them, a credit to the offensive line. I thought Steno had a really good plan this week in the run game. I thought Matt was dialing them up and going back to calls, you know, an expert level way that Matt called it tonight. And then obviously we executed the way we needed to.
Quarterback Aaron Rodgers, who threw four touchdowns and went over the 50,000 career passing yardage mark.
You know, I remember Farby talking about, you know, some of the milestones like this means you've been around a long time, played a lot of games, but there's also the consistency aspect to that, you know, being able to stay healthy for, you know, a decent amount of my career, minus a couple collarbones. And then being efficient for so long. There's a lot that goes into 50,000 yards. I'm proud of it. It's more of a longevity record.
Getting back to the game, as important as the offensive line's contributions were, so were the contributions of a couple of players having down seasons, specifically Darnell Savage and Preston Smith. Savage with a pair of interceptions and Smith with a fumble recovery for a touchdown.
It was huge for us. Obviously, Preston had the sack. He had the fumble recovery for a touchdown, which were critical, but I thought he did a nice job of putting pressure on the quarterback. And then also Savage, you know, he had a great week of practice, got a pick or two in practice, and it translated over to the game.
One more side note, and maybe it's because of the winning that comes along with it, but the relationship in Green Bay between coach and quarterback maybe has never been stronger than it is now.
I just feel like he's settled into his role as head coach. Him and I have been really on the same page all season. There's this just a beautiful trust that I think has blossomed even more this year between him and I, and I think that's an important part of us being successful is the QB and the coach calling and being on the same page. And, you know, obviously we've had a number of guys give more of themselves.
The final score, the Packers hammer the Bears 41-25, although it wasn't that close. At one point in the third quarter, it was 41-10. Chicago's last couple of touchdowns coming in garbage time, merely cosmetic to make the score look a little bit better. Taking a look at the standings, the Packers are in first place in the NFC North with an 8-3 record. Both the Vikings and Bears are now 5-6. We'll get to Minnesota momentarily. Detroit 4-7 on the year as well. We've got some news about the Lions as well from the weekend. Taking a look at the NFC as a whole, it's the Saints with the best record in the conference at 9-2, followed by the Packers again at 8-3. The Seahawks are 7-3. They'll play on Monday Night Football. The Rams are 7-4. The Buccaneers 7-5. Arizona now 6-5 after their loss yesterday. San Francisco, Minnesota, Chicago now all 5-6 so far on the season. Next week, the Packers host the 3-6-1 Philadelphia Eagles. We begin our look around the NFL with a chain of events that began on Thanksgiving Day.
Look at Duke Johnson tosses it back. And wide open is Fuller for the touchdown. Are you kidding?
I mean, this is unbelievable. Just silencing the fans in here, but this is outstanding play calling.
You know how many plays are run like this right now out in the backyards of America on Thanksgiving Day? This is a sandlot play, it looked like.
Just an absolute embarrassment. Not only that play, but the entire game as the Texans clobber the Lions 41-25. Really, again, an embarrassing display from a Detroit team that really has hit rock bottom under Coach Matt Patricia. Most disarmingly, everyone knew it at the time. After the game, Lions quarterback Matthew Stafford was asked,
"What would be your reason at this point to keep Matt Patricia as your head coach?"
"Not my decision. That's for somebody else. You want to ask me about the game, you can ask me about the game."
That was really all that needed to be said. That someone that Matthew Stafford was talking about was Lions owner Sheila Ford Hamp.
10 days ago, we looked like we had a good chance to be playoff bound. And, you know, both of those games were extremely disappointing. And it just seemed like the path going forward wasn't what we wanted it to be. So, yes, we thought this was a good time to make the change.
Head coach Matt Patricia, general manager Bob Quinn, both fired.
I meant what I said last December, and I still mean it. So, yes, things were not going well. It was not what we wanted. We were hoping to be playoff bound. I guess we still have a slight mathematical chance, but things were just not seeming to go in the right way.
In other words, the Patriot way just didn't work.
It was a hard decision just because, as I said, they're both terrific people. They've worked very hard and tirelessly for this organization. It clearly wasn't working. It wasn't what we had hoped for when we hired them, you know, and so I don't know if there was an exact moment. It's something we've been thinking about for several weeks and going back and forth and deciding, but clearly the last couple of games had a lot to do with it.
So for now, at least for the rest of the season, taking the reins in the Motor City, the guy who will forever be known in these parts for this.
Moss picks up the blitz. Bevel's got to scramble out of trouble. He's got a big opening at the 20. Bevel at the 15. Bevel at the 10. Bevel at the 5. Bevel's into the end zone! Darryl Bevel! That blazing speed takes him into the end zone.
Here's a name you haven't heard in a while. Brian Manthey on the call for the Badgers. By the way, that was his last Badgers call before Matt LaPay and Mike Lucas took over, starting with the 1994 season. But Darryl Bevel, after a couple of decades as a coach and coordinator, he gets a five-game run at the end of the season to see if he can salvage something in Detroit. Maybe this is his only shot to be a head coach, who knows? But it is the Darryl Bevel Show in the Motor City for the next month plus. Meanwhile, back to Sunday action. Minnesota trailed 21-10 when the fourth quarter began at home against Carolina. Then they went to work.
First and goal. Cousins fakes a toss right to Cook. He throws right to Justin. Yes! Touchdown, Vikings! It's Justin Jefferson's second touchdown today. Six for the season. It's 24-19 Carolina. Two receivers left and right. Cousins back to pass. Fires to the end zone! Yes! Touchdown, Vikings! Chad Beebe! Well done! Your first National Football League touchdown has made everybody forget about the muff, and it's tied the game at 27.
After the PAT, the score became 28-27. Vikings over the Panthers. That's how it ended. Minnesota improves to 5-6 on the season. Carolina falls to 4-8. Paul Allen with the calls on KFAN Radio in Minneapolis. The only team in front of the Packers in the NFC, New Orleans, who, of course, Green Bay already beat once this year. They were playing Denver, who had all four of their quarterbacks in COVID quarantine. In steps practice squad wide receiver Kendall Hinton, who charitably did the best that he could, being elevated from practice squad wide receiver to QB1 in the matter of about 40 hours.
I can easily say, you know, this has been the most eventful 24 hours of my life. But, you know, when I got the call, it was you know, pure excitement. You know, of course, there was nerves and disbelief, but you know, the encouragement the team have gave me, and you know, guys just keeping me up the whole time, they made it a lot easier for me.
Going from practice squad wide receiver to starting quarterback in the NFL is basically like taking the mayor of Oshkosh and making him president of the United States in that same time frame. You kind of know how government works, but you're not ready for the big job yet. It didn't necessarily go very well.
Second and goal from the two. Hill out of the gun. Now they run quarterback power, and Taysom Hill walks into the end zone, and there has still not been a team in the NFL has proven they can stop that play down tight, and the Saints go up 13-0 on a two-yard run by Taysom Hill.
Zach Strife on the call on WWL Radio in New Orleans. The final score, 31-3. The Saints demolished the Broncos. Hinton, he finished 1-for-9 of passing for 13 yards with two interceptions as the Broncos gained just 112 yards overall. That's their lowest output since gaining 128 yards in a 1992 loss at Washington. Hinton played 24 of the Broncos' 43 snaps on offense, and running backs Royce Freeman and Philip Lindsay took direct snaps the rest of the time. Meanwhile, the Patriots rallied furiously in the fourth against Arizona.
The kicker waits in the staggered stance. Cardona will snap it back. Bailey turns to Cardona. The snap in place. Swing of the right leg. Kick driven to the uprights. The kick is good!
Got it!
Ball does it again!
his second game winner of the season. And the Patriots prevailed the buzzer over Arizona by a 20-17 final.
Bob Soshi on the play-by-play on 98.5, the Sports Hub in Boston. The Patriots improved to 5-6 on the season. The Cardinals fall to 6-5. Meanwhile, in L.A., another buzzer beater. This one was between the Niners and the Rams.
Just inside the left hash to win the game. Pepper snap. Wisnowski has it down. Robbie Gould has it straight ahead. And good! The 49ers have beaten the L.A. Rams again! Twice this year, twice last year.
Sweep them up, baby.
The final score, 23-20. San Francisco with the win at Los Angeles. Greg Papa and Ted Robinson on the call on KNBR. The Niners improved to 5-6. The Rams fall to 7-4. In Buffalo, it was the Bills and the Chargers.
The snap. Josh Allen keeps it himself. Going to try to run to the corner of the end zone. He dives in, and is he in? Yes, touchdown, Buffalo. Josh Allen, a three-yard run.
Yeah, he got called for taunting.
Yeah, that didn't matter. The Bills still came away with the 27-17 win at home over the Chargers. John Murphy on the call on WGR for Buffalo. It was their first win over the Chargers since Week 7 in the 2008 season when they were the San Diego Chargers. Buffalo now 8-3 on the season. Chargers now 3-8 on the year. In Jacksonville, it was the Jaguars hosting the Browns. Don't look now, but Cleveland's legit.
Mayfield under center, turns, options it out. Here comes Nick Chubb to the corner. Touchdown, he's in. He's at 100 yards, and they're in the end zone.
Jacksonville trying to come back late, but it wasn't enough. Cleveland still comes away with a 27-25 victory. The Browns now 8-3 on the season. The Jags 1-10. Play-by-play courtesy of 850 ESPN in Cleveland. Jim Donovan on the call. In Atlanta, the Falcons did something that had to feel good. They demolished a team with a winning record. Final score, Atlanta 43, Las Vegas 6. Other games on Sunday, the Giants beat the Bengals 19-17. New York, don't look now, they're in first place with a 4-7 record in the putrid NFC East. Elsewhere, it was the Titans beating up on the Colts in Indianapolis 45-26. Also, Kansas City, a 27-24 winner at Tampa Bay. Changing gears, the NBA season isn't yet upon us, but NBA free agency is well underway, not just in Milwaukee, but all around basketball. For a national perspective on the league, we now turn to one of the very best. From NBA Radio and NBA TV, no one follows the association closer. Brian Geltzeiler joins me here on the show. Brian, as always, I appreciate the time very much.
My pleasure, Doug. How are you, sir?
I'm great. Did you get a chance to catch your breath after the shortest offseason in NBA history?
Not really, but that's okay. You know what? Listen, it's the truth of the matter is the NBA learned a very valuable lesson. It was by not really by choice, but that when you go up against a sports league that owns a day of the week, you're going to struggle in the ratings. And so the NBA made with the TV networks, made a decision that they got to run this thing back and get back to playing their playoffs and their finals on the calendar that we've been used to for all these years. So it made a pretty short offseason, but you got to remember something, Doug. Eight teams haven't played since March, and really every team except for four teams would have had the normal length of offseason. You know, the teams that made the conference finals don't get that, but everybody else does. So, you know, it's kind of a little bit of an equalizer for the teams that had the most success in the playoffs in the bubble in terms of them having to do a really quick turnaround. And I think it's actually a very interesting dynamic for the season and may create some parity where otherwise you may not have had some.
Well, one of those teams that didn't make it to the conference finals, they were certainly predicted to go to the conference finals at the beginning of the season, but got bounced in the second round by the Miami Heat, my hometown Milwaukee Bucks. And they've had an interesting week or so. How do you break down exactly what did and did not transpire in the Bucks front office these last couple of weeks?
All right, well, it's a tale of two stories, right? First story is obviously the holiday trade, which was a very risky trade and one of those trades that you make if you're relatively confident that Giannis Antetokounmpo is going to sign the Supermax. If he's going to sign that 5-year Supermax, it's a trade that you make because you strengthen what you have around him, give yourself a better chance to go win a title. But when you keep in mind Anthony Davis went for 3 first-round picks, and granted, 3 good young players, 1 all-star in Brandon Ingram, but in Lonzo Ball and Josh Hart, but still 3 first-round picks. you know, granted, the Bucks got off a bad contract in Bledsoe, but they also traded three first-round picks and two pick swaps for a guy in Drew Holiday that's made one All-Star team. So, that you know, that's a high price to pay for him. Listen, he helps you a ton. He's a really good two-way player, and they need a guy like that. So, and then there's, of course, the way that they butcher the Bogdanovich thing, which is there's lessons to be learned there. Listen, the Bucks got to get better at some of that. This is the only team in the league that got fined for tampering with their own player last year. So, I mean, they really have to be so careful about how they approach this stuff and did a smart thing when that blew up and walked away from Bogdanovich. The second story is how well they landed on their feet. You know what? DJ Augustine's a really good player for this team, and that's a good contract for him. He will help them a lot. He can defend. He can shoot a three. He will fit in really, really well with what they do. I actually love Bobby Portis for this team because I do think that they're going to have some lineups where they need to play essentially four perimeter guys around Giannis, and Bobby Portis can step out and shoot a three and still be able to defend the perimeter well enough for you. He's a good athletic big. I think he will help them a ton. I like Bryn Forbes, another guy that can come in there and make a shot. Keep in mind, you're probably not bringing Kyle Korver back, so Forbes is a guy that really helps. And you know what? Torrey Craig was someone that Michael Malone in Denver counted on a lot to guard some of the better perimeter players on other teams throughout the entire season. So I look at what they were able to add and how they landed on their feet there in adding Holiday. And keep in mind, they lost some guys that helped them a lot. George Hill shot 46% from three last year. Wes Matthews was a real good two-way player for them, especially on defensive end to the floor. Robin Lopez, granted, he didn't play a ton for them instead of Brooke, but you know, Robin Lopez opting out was a lucky thing for the Bucks because being able to go in the direction of Portis at a little bit less money, who's going to play more of a perimeter role and give you a different look when you have Brooke Lopez on the bench, ended up working out well. So all in all, I think the Bucks are a better team. But I'll say this, Doug. If Mike Budenholzer is not going to be more flexible in the playoffs in terms of the lineups he uses and the style of defense that he has them play, I mean, they got torn apart from behind the three-point line in that Miami series by Hero Robinson and Crowder. If you're not going to extend your defense out against good shooting teams in the playoffs, I'm afraid the results may end up being the same. So for all the everything they did on the roster side, there's got to be some different approaches now the team's coached.
The NBA will do their investigation certainly about the tampering. But in your best estimation, how much of that actually does go on in today's NBA?
A ton. And quite frankly, the NBA right now has got bigger fish to fry than worrying about tampering. The problem is when you announce a sign and trade on a restricted free agent, about 96 hours before free agency begins. Or let me rephrase that. You don't announce it. You let it leak because it leaked. When something like that leaks, you leave yourself in a bad spot with two things. Number one, you leave yourself in a bad spot with the fact that the league can come down on you if they want to. And the league felt like they were made to look bad by the Bucks. That, you know, they weren't really going to look to enforce this stuff this year. And I understand why. Again, much bigger fish to fry. So there's that factor. Here's the other factor in all this that people have not talked about. You know, the Bucks, to my understanding, were going to be paying Bogdanovich in a neighborhood of $15 million a year. The offer sheet he signed with Atlanta was for $18 million a year. So what they did is they set a market for Bogdanovich, and they gave his agent an opportunity, once this whole thing looked like it might unwind, to go shop it. So they were able to shop it an upgrade, and he was able to upgrade and get more money and essentially use the Bucks in all this. So the Bucks didn't do themselves any favors in any of it. And again, everybody does this in the league, but very few do and let this leak in the way Milwaukee does. It was just it's a sloppy chapter for the Bucks, but again, I do believe they landed on their feet because one other very important factor here that I didn't mention before, I love Dante DiVincenzo. Keeping Dante DiVincenzo to me, I think, is very important. And I think if you give him a little bit of time, he actually may be a better player for the Bucks and a more effective player than Bogdanovich.
It seems as though for at least the last 18 months to 2 years, one of the biggest stories, and maybe I'm hypersensitive to it because I live in Milwaukee, but it's where Giannis is going to wind up. Will he sign the Supermax? It seems as though there are some in NBA circles who are desperate to get him to either the Lakers or the Clippers or the Warriors or a bigger market team so he can flourish and win a championship and play with superstars. What are you hearing, and what's your best estimation as to where he'll be playing 2 years from now?
I think he'll be in Milwaukee. I listen, the general mentality from what I'm hearing is that he's going to sign the Supermax and stay in Milwaukee with the thought that you sign, you know, the what's happening with players, and look at it with Anthony Davis, look at what's happening with James Harden in Houston right now. Sign the big contract, and then if you need to get out, you can figure out your way out in 2 years. And it may take you a year to get out, but you can eventually get yourself out if that's what you think you need to do. So I think that's what Giannis is looking at. I don't know that he's necessarily saying, I'm going to stay a full 5 years in Milwaukee, but right now he doesn't want to necessarily leave. He's going to, and again, there's some other decent options out there for him if he wanted to do it. Dallas is leaving powder dry for him. Toronto is, and Miami was until they signed Bam Adebayo to an extension. And what's interesting about Miami and that is, listen, Pat Riley doesn't make mistakes. They looked at this situation and believe in their heart of hearts Giannis is staying in Milwaukee, because they could have very easily waited. This is an early extension for Adebayo that doesn't kick in this year. It kicks in next year. And as we know in the NBA offseason, order of operations is extremely important, Doug. And what Miami could have done, especially if they're willing to go in well into the tax, is they could have essentially signed Giannis in free agency and then turned around and signed Bam as their own free agent to that same extension next offseason. But if they don't believe they're getting Giannis, honest, why are you going to, you know, make Bam think he's not valued as much as he's valued and give him his money now? So I think that that's a surefire sign for Miami that they believe in their heart of hearts that Giannis is staying in Milwaukee. And that's everything I'm hearing as well. And I'd be surprised if he doesn't sign that Supermax between now and the beginning of the season.
You mentioned James Harden, as we're joined by NBA Radio and NBA TV's Brian Geltzeiler. Where did that relationship sour between Harden and the Rockets?
Daryl Morey played an enormous role in how productive that relationship was over the years. James Harden had a tremendous trust in Daryl that he would find ways to continue to improve that team. And in a lot of ways, Daryl Morey was able to kind of be a buffer and insulate James Harden from some of the realities of playing on a team owned by Tillman Fertitta. And when Morey left there, those realities were stripped bare. Listen, Fertitta, under the best of circumstances, doesn't necessarily want to go in and pay the luxury tax. But right now, during a pandemic, with the restaurant casino business in the crapper, for lack of a better term, he's certainly not going to do it now. And I think what's happened, and there's a couple things are in place. Number one, I do think that some of his political affiliations are bothersome to some NBA players. I know there's been stories out there about that. I think there's some truth to that. And then there's, of course, when it comes to Fertitta, his lack of willingness to spend money and him pretending that he's willing to. I think that those two things do not add up at all. Keep in mind that he's got Raphael Stone, a rookie general manager, and he's got a rookie head coach in Steven Silas, and I don't believe he's paying them all that much. He lowballed Mike D'Antoni on a 1-year extension that D'Antoni refused to receive. He didn't fight to keep Daryl Morey because he was pretty happy to get out from under Daryl Morey's $8 million a year that he was making. So you combine all of these things and everything that's gone on, James Harden sees that. And he doesn't want to necessarily be a part of that. He wants to go to an organization where ownership is going to put their money where their mouth is. That's not Tillman Fertitta right now. And listen, I will say this. Right now, I don't blame him. Right now, he's in a very tough spot when it comes to where he is business-wise. Last year, I blamed him. Listen, they gave us all the small ball nonsense last year about how this is the big revolution. We made this big basketball decision. You made a financial decision because you didn't want to pay Clint Capella anymore, and you wanted to make sure you came in below the tax. And Covington was making $5 million less than Capella, and it made the deal palatable for them. So they framed it as a basketball decision when it was a financial decision. So that kind of BS that's thrown out, over time, you can get away with one or two of those, but when those keep happening over and over and over again, your star players are going to see through it. And I think, listen, I think Harden may have a tougher time getting out of there than Westbrook. I think they'd be very happy to trade Russell Westbrook if they're able to get a package back that they can sell to their fans. And right now, they just haven't gotten that offer. They gave up a whole bunch of picks for Westbrook. 2 picks and 2 pick swaps. They're not seeing any of those back.
Could you imagine James Harden? I know he wanted to go to Brooklyn, but I don't know how they pay everybody when you've got Kyrie, KD's coming back, and then Harden. I mean, I know that it puts Brooklyn in the driver's seat in the East, but how do you pay everybody?
Brooklyn's got salaries to send back, Doug. They, Caris LeVert would leave a deal like that. He's making about $18 million a year. So you're almost halfway to Harden just with that. Spencer Dinwiddie's making around 11. So now all of a sudden for Harden's 40 and change, you're at 29 already. If you threw in a player like Torian Prince, who's making in the neighborhood of 13, you're there. And you know, so that how they're going to pay him is not the issue. Because the other thing is Joseph Tsai is, you know, he's the CEO and the founder of Alibaba. He's a very, very wealthy guy. He's made a lot of money during the pandemic. That stock's gone crazy. So he has no problem paying luxury tax. What your issue is with Brooklyn making this deal is that, you know, look at the going price for these kinds of stars. Paul George went for 5 first-round picks. Anthony Davis went for, you know, three players and 3 picks, and the 3 players were all young studs. So the going price is heavy. Brooklyn just got done with that. Sean Marks, their GM and team president, he got there and had a mess because of the Pearson Garnett deal and the 3 firsts and the 2 pick swaps they gave up in that deal. So he got there and had to clean up from that mess. He's not in a hurry to do that again and throw all those picks in for James Harden. And that's why you're going to see Brooklyn's going to start this season. And they have a really good team, Brooklyn, a really good team. And they want to see if this works now without James Harden. So yeah, so you have an ownership with deep pockets. You have the salaries to send back. They don't want to send the picks back. And essentially, they're going to look to Stonewall Houston as much and as long as they can, as long as Harden has a one-team market for him. Now, again, Philly's the other team you hear a lot of, but unless Ben Simmons is going back in that deal, Philly doesn't have anything Houston's going to want. So I think for Harden to get where he wants to get, it's going to be a lot tougher, and I think he'll be patient and hang where he is till he has an opportunity to get to go to one of those places, as opposed to looking to just push his way out to get out and have something that happened like with Kawhi. Now, listen, Kawhi won a title in Toronto. Doesn't mean it was his first choice of where he wanted to go for that year. I don't think James Harden's going to want to do that, so I think he'll look to work a little more with the Rockets on him.
The Lakers, NBA champions, what's their window? LeBron James entering, what, season 17 or 18 of his career? He's fantastic. But what's their window right now for this ascension and being at the top of the heap where they are with the guys that they've got?
At least 2 more years, Doug. And I'm going to tell you, I think that the Lakers made the single best/impactful move that any team made during this offseason, and it was the first move anybody made in the offseason. The Dennis Schroeder trade was a stroke of genius. Dennis Schroeder, at 27 years old, they're going to sign him to a long-term deal. He is going to be a great partner for Anthony Davis going forward. The two of them together are going to extend LeBron in LeBron's prime a little bit. LeBron still looks like he's in his prime, but LeBron has learned if you got the right guard to trust, and Schroeder can play, he can play on the ball, and as he showed us last year playing with Chris Paul in OKC, he can play off the ball too. Schroeder is a fantastic player. He was the second best player on that OKC team last year. And even with Chris Paul on the team, their best clutch shooter. He is a high speed, fast break type of player. I think he's going to be terrific for them. I know everybody's loved their offseason, and I like some things that they did in their offseason too. I thought Matthews was an upgrade from Danny Green, and they did a real good job getting him. Obviously, I love Schroeder. Two other moves that they made that I'm not going gaga over. I'm very happy they brought back Markieff Morris. I think he's an important player for them in terms of when they like to play their lineups a little bit smaller as a guy that can handle 4 or 5 for them. I think Marc Gasol's finished. I really do. I from what I saw with him in the bubble and what I saw even before that, he was never the fastest player in the world, and age has robbed whatever quickness he had left, and I think he's a big-time plotter. Will he guard Jokic for maybe 10-12 minutes a game against Denver? I think that's where his maximum use is, and I just don't see how Montrezl Harrell fits on this team at all. That's a move I made me scratch my head a little bit, just because I don't think you can play Harrell on the floor down the stretch of a playoff game, because he really can't guard anybody defensively. And he's also a guy that, I mean, he single-handedly blew up the Clipper locker room last year. And there's a star system in L.A. all over again. And if Harrell's not getting his minutes and his touches, and especially on a contract that he deems is under what his market value was, and essentially went there because the Clippers wouldn't make him an offer, he wanted to stick it to them. And once Atlanta signed Gallinari, he didn't have anything to leverage. So I think for Harrell, he's feeling a little, you know, like he didn't get the money he should get, and he's going to look for minutes and touches to try to create his next contract. He's in the wrong place for that. So I don't think everything they did was wonderful, but this Schroeder move is going to be, it's the best thing that could have happened to LeBron at this stage of his career.
NBA Radio's Brian Geltzeiler. Follow him on Twitter at HoopsCritic. Brian, you're the best. Thanks so much for the time and the insights.
Happy and healthy to you and yours, Doug. It's always my pleasure. We'll do it again soon, pal.
It's not just the NBA. College basketball has begun its season as well. And for my money, no one knows the college game better than my next guest. He's been the senior college basketball writer for the Sporting News for the past few decades. He's been a longtime contributor to the Big Ten Network's coverage of college hoops. The great Mike DeCourcy joins me now. Mike, thanks so much for the time today.
Always a pleasure. Great to hear from you.
COVID, of course, has been the story of 2020. College football has certainly had its issues. What can college basketball do to learn from football in terms of how to keep the virus from wiping out huge chunks of the season?
Well, I think, first of all, I do think that college football is getting more. I don't think they're getting enough credit for what they're accomplishing. I do think that we tend to focus on what is not happening, and then the games come on Saturday and we pay attention to what's happening, and then we get right back to forgetting that all happened. We have a much more established college football season than we expected. And yes, there are continue to be issues in the sport of college football. And I'm sure there will continue to be as they move on toward the playoffs. But what I think that college basketball has an advantage now, and what college football eventually will have an advantage as well, is that they are entering a period when campuses are basically closing up, with the exception of the football players who will be there for a couple more weeks and longer, of course, if they happen to be selected for bowl games and college football playoff, and the basketball players who will be there through November, December, January, et cetera, that the campuses are mostly going to be otherwise vacant. And I think that's a huge advantage right now. It flies in opposition to those, including Rick Pitino, who continue to say you should delay the college basketball season and start it later and play the NCAA tournament in May. And my feeling about that, and I know the NCAA feels this, is that you would be then taking the players away from a circumstance in which their contact with the public can be at the very lowest because of these empty campuses, and putting them right back into the situation that they're coming out of now. I don't think there's logic to that. I think that's the advantage that college basketball has as this begins. Now, it'll take a little while for it to have its impact, because a lot of programs, as they enter the season, as they get tested before competition, are now starting to learn that they already had players who were positive, and so they have to be shut down for a little while. But as they get past that and their contact with the public diminishes, then they get there's a very strong chance that they'll get into a season that maybe is less disrupted than it otherwise would be. I think there's a good chance to that. And there's the fact that we're hearing reports that the current recommendation of a 2-week quarantine is likely to be reduced. That there has been some reporting on that, and not in terms of basketball. You know, the quarantine is coming, recommendations coming from the CDC, and they're saying that maybe it doesn't need to be as long as what originally was suggested. And if that gets applied then to college basketball, then the shutdowns that do happen may not have to be as protracted, and therefore not as many games missed or rescheduled or canceled.
I saw last week, Mike, reports of the entire 68-team, 67-game NCAA tournament likely to be played in one city, the likely one that was being mentioned, Indianapolis. Logistically speaking, with everything that goes into 68 teams in a 3-week tournament, how hard is that going to be to pull off?
Well, I think, first of all, it's less likely to be one city than one region. It will have as its hub, the city of Indianapolis, but then there's a very good chance that spokes reach out to Bloomington, perhaps at Assembly Hall, or to Mackey Arena in West Lafayette, or to the Holman Center in Terre Haute, where Indiana State plays, or up to Ball State in Muncie. I think there's a very good chance they use all of those, in addition to the arenas that are here in Indianapolis, from Lucas Oil Stadium, which will be the Final Four site for sure, perhaps maybe some regionals as well. We'll see how what they decide to do. You also have Bankers Life, where the Pacers play. You have Butler, which has already stepped forward and said, "Hey, you know, we're in. We'll do whatever you need." And they have Hinkle Fieldhouse, which would be a great site for games. And there is another arena on the state fairgrounds where IUPUI plays. So there are a number of arenas that they can use in addition to the Final Four site. And I think they have a chance to do that. It's probably not going to feel quite the same in terms of Doug, you've been at NCAA tournament games, and basically what happens is one game gets played, and while the winners are celebrating, the losers are commiserating, and somebody's being interviewed on the court by CBS or Turner, boom, they put 29 minutes or 30 minutes up on the clock, and two more teams come out and start doing layup lines and get ready for the next game. That's not going to happen. I mean, that eventually those two teams will come out of their tunnel and play, but not until after everything kind of gets shut down, people get removed from the arena, they sanitize the place, they wipe it down or whatever, and then they can continue with another game. So it will be a different feel. I don't think we're going to see four game days in the same arena any longer. Right, I shouldn't say any longer, for this particular year. I think it'll be different in that way, and that's why I do believe they're going to have to incorporate other arenas so that they can move the tournament along. You have to eliminate 67 teams over the course of whatever period of time you do, and I don't know that it'll be quite as compressed. I know for certain that it will not immediately start. Dan Gavitt told us this after the announcement. It will not start 2 days after with the first four after Selection Sunday. They need more time to establish the controlled environment. Don't call it a bubble. They need more time to do that. So they haven't said how long the lag would be. They haven't said then when the tournament will begin and how it will be structured exactly. But it's still going to be 68 teams. It's still going to be the same concept, the same bracket concept. You just have it all here in this area.
Let's talk about the actual season in and of itself. I was looking through the Sporting News preseason top 25. I see a lot of Big Ten representation, Illinois at 5, Wisconsin at 6, Iowa at 8, Michigan State and Michigan also in the top 25. As we enter this season, in your estimation, is that the league that has the most talent right now?
No, absolutely the best teams. Most talent is are we talking about NBA? You'll probably find more NBA potential in Kentucky or whatever, where the mock drafts will probably not be flocking to the Big Ten at the same level that they do to places like Kentucky or Duke or wherever. But that's where they have the best teams in terms of number and depth and quality. Three in the top 10 for us. And we're not, as you said, I do work at Big Ten Network, so I really know the league extremely well, but we're not alone in that. We might have it ordered differently. I know others have had Iowa higher or Illinois higher, but we're not alone in having four Big Ten teams in the top dozen or so. Others have even more in the top 25 than we chose to put in. Others have had Rutgers. Ohio State has been in for some. Indiana was on the very border of the AP top 25. I think they were the 27th or 28th team. So there is great depth in the league. I don't know if it goes quite as deep as it did a year ago. We'll see. Because a year ago when I did the brackets for Fox, I believe my final bracket had 10 Big Ten teams in it. And I don't know whether we'll have 10 this year. But I feel pretty confident that the ones we do have will be higher on the bracket. More of them will be higher on the bracket than they were on the projected bracket last March.
Who's the best team no one's talking about right now? I mean, I'm looking at the AP top 25 right now, or at least the AP top 10. You know, I think most have Gonzaga at number one, and then some form of, right now it's the AP with Baylor, Villanova, Virginia. You mentioned Iowa. The AP has them at number 5, Kansas, Wisconsin. But who's the best team that nobody's talking about right now?
That's kind of a funny question, Doug, because I don't hear anybody talking about anything other than cancellations. And nobody wants to talk about hoops. So I guess it depends on how you look at it. I think we have Wisconsin rated a little higher than some. That's a team that is completely intact. and that I think the players, I think Micah Potter's going to be a much better Wisconsin player over the course of this season than he was over the course of last season. Part of that is because he wasn't allowed to join the team until midseason. It took him a little while to get totally underway, and he didn't really find his rhythm until the end of the season. So I think he'll be a much more effective player. I think Tyson Wahl, who was a freshman last year, I really like his game. There are certain Wisconsin players you see early in their careers and you say, that guy's going to be a really good player before he gets out of here. And I felt that way about Ethan Happ when he was a freshman. And I'm not saying that Tyson's going to be the player who becomes like the leading scorer and rebounder in Wisconsin history. But I saw a spark in his game that I think he's going to be an excellent player. And so he may not have he'll have a somewhat bigger role this year. The guys in front of him are still in front of him, but I think he'll have a bigger impact. If you look at it from the other side, the other edge of the top 25, I like Richmond. A year ago, I mean, I'm not saying that they're going to be Dayton out of the Atlantic 10 this year, but there's some very good teams in the Atlantic 10. Rhode Island's very good. St. Louis is very good. Dayton will be very good again this year, although they don't have Obi Toppin, so they won't be that team. But I think the team that looks most promising out of the A-10 is Richmond, with pretty much their lineup back. Their guards are intact. Jacob Gilliard, terrific player. I think Richmond's going to be pretty dangerous and not a lot of fun to play, and they get a shot at just the right time. I mean, the perfect time to play Kentucky is on the first weekend, because Kentucky is going to get better because they've got so many freshmen. They're going to get better over the course of the year. So if you get them now, they maybe aren't all the way there yet, but by the end, you're getting credit for beating a top three seed or so, maybe. So this is a great possibility for Richmond over the weekend.
How many coaches, in your opinion, got maybe a reprieve? I don't know if that's the right word or not, because of COVID. Because unless I'm missing
right
some,
that is,
is it?
I think it is. I mean, when you know that keeping your job in this business is a challenge, and if you get to keep it, it's a reward. The money's great, and if it weren't a fun way to make a living, Mike Krzyzewski wouldn't be doing it in his 70s. Roy Williams wouldn't be doing it in his 70s. And Jim Calhoun wouldn't have come back to coach in D3. And Jim Boeheim wouldn't be doing it in his late 70s. And it's got to be a fun way to make a living, right? So those who got to stay, I'm sure that they're happy that they got the chance. It's like maybe it gives them a second life. Maybe somebody would have gotten fired, and then all of a sudden they got just the right player in, and they're going to turn it completely around. How many that is, I don't, so much has gone on since last March that I don't really know how many would have gone, because it's cyclical, because, you know, a bunch of coaches get fired, and then you can't make new changes again because you just fired the other guys. And so I don't know whether last spring would have been a heavy firing season. I don't think it would have been, but I can guarantee you there are at least 5 to 10 high major coaches who probably wouldn't have jobs if it hadn't been for the pandemic. And the schools didn't want to write buyout checks, and I understand that totally. And they felt like a lot of coaches didn't really get a chance to show at the end whether or not they had, you know, one last run in them to show you what they were capable of. And so very few coaches lost their jobs at the high major level in the off season. And this gives them a chance to maybe have a rebirth.
So in that same vein then, Mike, what coaches need to win the most this season?
You know, Doug, I never do that. I don't do hot seats. I don't feel it's my place. Those coaches know who they are and what they need to do. I'm never comfortable in saying if this guy doesn't win enough, he should be fired. You should fire your coach when you believe that your program is not headed in the right direction. And that can involve a lot of things, and it shouldn't involve, well, we missed the tournament this many years in a row or whatever. It should never involve that. It should be about our players aren't responding to our coach. Our coach isn't recruiting the type of players that fit our institution. our coach doesn't respond to, you know, our fans do not appreciate the way this coach responds publicly to his fan base. All those things go into whether or not a coach is the right person for a particular job. It should never be based on, well, he just didn't make the tournament enough years in a row, or has missed too many times or whatever. I really admire the programs that understand how that works, because they're the ones that usually have the most success.
I think everybody's Taylor is probably going to get fired, though, because I see a lot of coaches that are going to eschew the suits on the sidelines this year. So if there's anybody that's really going to feel the brunt of it, it might be the haberdashers around the league.
This is what I'm hearing, and I am highly upset about it.
I know. I was going to throw that one in right there at the end just for you, Mike, because I saw something about that.
I saw Seth Davis say that coaches are going to start wearing polo shirts, and that just hurts me. It hurts my soul. It really does. Polo shirts are like the fast food of fashion. They are the worst. You will never see me in a polo shirt unless it's like required by my job or something. If I'm a coach, I'm doing, like, even if I'm not wearing my suit, and I'm not sure whether or not I would abandon the suit right now. I'd want to stand out. I'm putting on my Hugo Boss or my Ted Baker. And I'm looking, and I'm saying, you don't look as good as me, and my team is gonna outdo you too. That's what I would be doing. I mean, I saw a picture that was in Seth Davis's tweet that was of Jay Wright, who is the single most fashionable person in college basketball history. He is such a handsome guy, and he was wearing a polo shirt. And I'm like, he can't even make a polo shirt look good. How can we say that's the way to go?
You can catch his outstanding work at the Sporting News. Follow him on Twitter at TSN Mike, and then, of course, also on Big Ten Network as well. Well, college basketball season is here. We're grateful that college basketball season is here. Hopefully, they don't have very many cancellations throughout the course of the year, but we will follow you and we'll see you on Big Ten Network, and obviously read your great work in the Sporting News as well. Great to talk to you. Great to catch up with you. Thank you so much for the time.
Thanks, Doug.
Thanks, Mike. There he goes. Mike DeCourcy here on the Doug Russell Podcast. To boxing, believe it or not, Mike Tyson and Roy Jones Jr. returned to the ring on Saturday night in Los Angeles. Yes, it was an exhibition, and it was officially a draw on the final scorecard, but that's just the backdrop to the best Mike Tyson rant of all time from 20 years ago.
I was going to rip his heart out. I'm the best ever. I'm the most brutal and vicious and most ruthless champion there's ever been. There's no one can stop me. Lynx is a conqueror. No, I'm Alexander. He's no Alexander. I'm the best ever. There's never been anybody as ruthless. I'm Sonny Liston. I'm Jack Dempsey. There's no one like me. I'm from Nairclaw. There's no one that can match me. My style is impetuous. My defense is impregnable. And I'm just ferocious. I want your heart. I want to eat his children. Praise be to Allah.
That's when boxing was interesting. Staying in Los Angeles this weekend was the great Vin Scully's 93rd birthday. Maybe the nicest man I've ever met. The Dodgers retweeted this 5-minute tribute to Vin this weekend. This was from when Vin Scully retired at the end of the 2016 season. So, yes, you'll hear the voices of the late Dick Enberg and Kobe Bryant in this tribute. But here are some of the other voices that you'll hear as well. Actor Bryan Cranston, the great Al Michaels, Charlie Steiner, George Will, George Lopez, Joe Torre, Joe Buck, Magic Johnson, Peter O'Malley, Jaime Jarrín, who is the Spanish language version of Vin Scully, Jaime Jarrín, in the Baseball Hall of Fame as well. He's been broadcasting in Spanish for the Dodgers since they moved to Los Angeles from Brooklyn. So Jaime Jarrín is a legend in his own right. You'll also hear from former Dodgers first baseman Steve Garvey, along with Dodgers legendary manager Tommy Lasorda. I think he's in his mid-90s at this point as well. But Vin Scully turning 93 this weekend. So this was a tribute that the Dodgers had from 5 years ago. They retweeted it, and I thought you'd enjoy it. If you love Vin Scully as much as I do, or even a fraction of as much as I do, you will love this tribute to the great broadcaster.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant good evening to you wherever you may be.
How can you not miss someone who's been speaking to you for the past 67 seasons? The guy with the soothing voice, who wishes us a very pleasant good evening. The storyteller, who invites us to pull up a chair. The artist, who paints pictures with words. And most of all, the man who refers to us as friends. The Dodgers are an organization that's been in existence for 126 years. And for more than half of that time, Vincent Edward Scully has been their voice. Yeah, he's going to be missed, not just by Dodger fans, but by baseball overall. He's our bridge to the past, to the history, to the legends, and the personalities of this great game.
It's time for Dodger baseball.
You know it's a change of season, the smell of cut grass, and the air is different, and you hear his voice ring up, and you just get excited.
Well, I have been listening to Vin Scully my entire life. I first heard him when I was 6 years old.
Oh, when you're a kid, you want to be a fireman or you want to be a baseball. I wanted to be the Dodger announcer. And the reason I wanted to be the Dodger announcer when I was 7 years old in New York was the first time I heard Vin's voice on the radio.
Aristotle said human beings are language-using creatures. What makes us human, really, is our ability to use words to connect with one another. And no one uses words to connect with so many people for so long in so many ways, so wonderfully, as Vin Scully.
You know, Vin is that favorite sweater of yours that you can't wait to put on the chilly day. Just makes you comfortable every time you hear his voice.
I was always able to listen to Vin call a game, and even if it was just for the 3 hours, he just seemed to make everything all right.
He just means everything to you. When people come and go out of your life, he's always there. And when you're having a tough time in life, he's always there. And he's been the good uncle to all of us who love baseball.
You know, it occurs to me that when Vin Scully broke in with the Brooklyn Dodgers under Red Barber in 1950, there had to be players still active who had been playing during the 1930s. And there will be players who broke in this year or last year who will still be active in the 2030s. So as yet another mark of the uniqueness and greatness of Vin Scully, he will have called games played in by players whose careers literally are separated by a full century.
Everybody was bringing transistor radios out in the 60s, and here I am in the batter's box, and I struck out, and I can still hear Vin Scully saying I struck out, which sort of makes you not really care that much, you know, because he sounded so good.
You know, obviously, I've been trying this profession for a long while, and I'm the son of somebody who did it for almost 50 years at the big league level, and I have absolutely no problem saying that the best to ever sit behind a microphone to call a Major League Baseball game or any game is Vin Scully.
You sit there in awe of his delivery and his ability to just relate to you, and you think you're Vince's best friend. And you've never met him.
He loves baseball. He respects baseball. He understands baseball. He's genuine with his friends, with his family, with the fans, and in his work.
He's not only a man for all seasons, but a man for all sports. He's done a wonderful job in football and in golf. And I guess that tells you about his professionalism, that he's able to go from one sport to another and still maintain that admiration.
He has been really the inspiration of my life because he has been close to me all these years.
To me, it's an amazing thing, the longevity, the enthusiasm, the artistry, it's everything. I mean, without question, the greatest broadcaster in baseball history, and that is not arguable.
I think it's important to appreciate him and his legacy and what he means, just the sports as a whole. And I hope he feels that love and he feels the embrace and how much the city of Los Angeles and how much the sports community loves him.
I don't know what we're going to do without him. We're going to miss him and we're going to remember him forever.
He has been my hero, my teacher, my mentor, my friend. And I thank God for that.
During a broadcast in 1991, Vin said this: Andre Dawson has a bruised knee, and he's listed as day-to-day. Aren't we all? Just another Scully jewel. Well, following the Dodgers day-to-day is never going to be quite the same. But tonight, we celebrate and thank the broadcaster, the storyteller, our friend, Vin Scully.
Great, great stuff. We close today with one final look at the Thanksgiving holiday and the greatest Thanksgiving-themed episode of television ever broadcast. No, I'm not going to give you the whole 22 minutes, but the last couple of minutes of the Great Turkey Drop from WKRP in Cincinnati.
The crowd is moving out into the parking area, and, oh yes, I can see it now. It's a helicopter, and it's coming this way. It's flying something behind it. I can't quite make it out. It's a large banner, and it says, Happy Thanksgiving from WKRP. What a sight, ladies and gentlemen. What a sight. The copter seems to be circling the parking area now. I guess it's looking for a place to land. No, something just came out of the back of the helicopter. It's a dark object. Perhaps a skydiver plumbing to the earth from only 2,000 feet into the air. Second to the third. There's no parachutes yet.
Those can't be skydivers. I can't tell just yet what they are, but...
Oh, my God, they're turkeys! Oh, Johnny, can you get this? Oh, they're crashing to the earth right in front of my eyes! One just went through the windshield of a parked car!
Running around pushing each other? Oh my goodness! Oh, the humanity! People are running about. The turkeys are hitting the ground like sacks of wet cement. See, folks, I don't know how much longer the crowd is running for their lives. I think I'm going to step inside. I can't stay out here and watch this anymore. No, I can't go in there.
Children are searching for their mothers, and oh, not since the Hindenburg tragedy has there been anything like this.
Absolute classic television. In fact, it wasn't just the turkey drop from that episode of WKRP in Cincinnati, but that entire show, that's one of the big things that made me want to go into radio in the first place. I absolutely loved that show, loved the antics of Mr. Carlson and Herb Tarlick and Dr. Johnny Fever and Les Nessman and Venus Flytrap and Jennifer Marlowe and program director Andy Travis. The whole just ensemble cast from top to bottom was absolutely top shelf, and it made radio look like it was fun, and it made radio look like something that I wanted to do for my career. And so whomever created, I don't even know who the creator was, but to whomever created it, I am eternally grateful for that, because it has been a hell of a ride for the last 30 years. Thanks to our guests, Mike DeCourcy and Brian Geltzeiler. And of course, thanks to you, most importantly, for listening to the podcast today. As always, you can find us on our socials, Twitter and Instagram at Doug Russell Pod. You can search for the Doug Russell Podcast on Facebook and YouTube. Email us at DougRussellPod@gmail.com. And for all of it, you can find our email, you can find our episodes, of course, you can find our videos, you can find whatever we do all in one place. It's very simple, DougRussellPod.com. Again, that's our new website, DougRussellPod.com. Have a great start to your week. We'll see you on Wednesday.